How do we experience the presence of God? Christians say, He's here. Others I know are pretty sure He isn't present. So why are we right and why are they wrong? Or how can we possibly communicate across that divide? We Christians experience Him, but when you think about it, that experience is hard to describe. Ask the average Christian, me included, you know, if I'm average at all, I say, well, I just feel it. I just know somehow that it's true. Now, actually, you know, that approach can be defended philosophically. Some experiences are just truly basic. But the approach has its limits. As strong as it might be that you can actually argue that way, from a pastoral or a practical standpoint, how you experience God, just saying, I feel it, doesn't carry you very far because of all those times when you don't just feel it, when everything around you says, you know, it's really pretty unlikely that God is present, or at least that's how it feels. Well, then what happens? You say, well, at that point I just hunkered down, and it's a question of faith. The world seems to be saying, no God, but I'm stubborn enough to say, yes, there is. Well, you know, oddly, that can be defended too, philosophically. I mean, obviously, a faith that can't fly in the face of the evidence once in a while, or even for long distances, isn't really much faith at all. But still, on a practical level, it has its limits, because it's kind of a miserable way to go. You've undoubtedly experienced your own doubts and periods of doubt like that. So I'd say it's worth it to think about, well, how do you experience God? What is the experience of God like? And hopefully it will save you some moments of confusion and stress when you think, well, it isn't clearly always all about my feelings. Feelings are tricky business when it comes to faith. Thinking about how it is that we experience God then helps me also to discern, well, when is it really God present? Is it my experience of God? And when is it that when all practical purposes are stated, it's really just time and chance and normal human existence? Or maybe, too, it will help us to think about how we experience God to say, well, maybe we experience Him at times and we just don't realize it. And it takes a little bit of wisdom and faith to shine some light into us and open us up and say, well, you know, really? That is where and when I experience God. Maybe we're missing Him in places where we actually could begin to understand ourselves as quite close to Him. It all comes down to something for me that's very important. Your personal, direct connection to God. Unmediated, immediate. It must always be the center of every Christian life and of every Christian day. And I don't think it should ever be taken for granted. It is the source, the center, the first element from which any of the rest of the picture of Christian life, whatever it might be, whatever that might, whether it be your life in the church, your life of discipleship, your morality, any picture you can paint of a Christian life of faith, it had better get back to that center. It better be fed from that center at all times, your immediate, direct connection to God, your experience of Him. And what I want in life, and don't want to settle for anything less as a religious man, is a life connected to God. So don't feel I'm overstating this to make my case. I want a life that's about God through Jesus and the Holy Spirit. And I've found that as I've gotten older, it's put me at war. War is the only way I can describe it, at war with a Christian life that is reduced to being busy at church. I've seen it, and it's lost from the center. I'm at war with a life that's holding moral rigorous standards just to see if other people could improve through my shining examples. That doesn't work too well. I'm at war with seeing if you can improve other people. I'm at war with a Christian faith that's about politics and carping about government. I've watched that run the ship up on rocks over the last 20 years. I'm at war with all the reductions of Christian faith that lose God at the center, that make life a commitment of faith, merely a lifestyle. For instance, another thing I've seen in my life is a great emphasis on Christian family, which is very important. A great family is a wonderful thing. But let me digress for a moment on that. Even that becomes a kind of an idolatry. Even a family life can knock you off center. Luke 14, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. If you want to have fun sometime, run that passage from Luke through the commentaries and watch them scramble. They really have trouble. He didn't really mean that. Well, you know, when all was said and done, he really meant that. Yes, he did. So I'm saying it bluntly. Even the really good things in life, the things we value and think are important, can be knocked out of place, and they make little sense, really, in the Christian picture unless the love of God and the experience of God, direct and immediate, isn't at the center. If you put it this way, let me just say, you have to live in him before you can live for him. You have to live in Christ before you can live for Christ. As Jesus said in John 15, abide in me. What's it mean to abide? And I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit. For without me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and is withered, and they gather them and throw them into the fire, and they are burned. We're just shriveled up and dying. We're branches ready for the bonfire if we somehow aren't vitally, directly, and immediately connected to God. So I say, what is that experience? How do I know it is happening? How can I cultivate it and nurture it in my life? How do I experience the presence of God? Well, obviously, when you're looking at the scriptures, there's a real choice there. Which ones will you pick? And I decided to pick a psalm, Psalm 33. Psalms are a good place to see how another person experiences God. And in Psalms, you're really allowed an inside view of someone else's thoughts. They're internal. Do you realize it's a very privileged view? Even your close friends don't let you inside their thoughts quite at this level of intimacy. Even your own spouse might not let you there a lot of time, might not be able to articulate it. I mean, this is the great, great wonder of poetry, if you will, but now we're talking about an inspired writer saying, you can now see the world through my eyes, and I will allow you to experience God as I experience God. A privileged view of the experience of God. I'll give you several reasons, though, why I love the Psalms and think they're worth your time for meditating, particularly on this particular topic. First, in the Psalms, there are no cliches and no canned metaphors. I mean, sorry for all the songwriters and people who want to coax our worship out of us. I mean, I'm not referring here. I mean, just generally in the world, in the history of the church, it falls back into cliches and canned metaphors. You won't see a single one in the Psalms. They're all fresh. They're all unique. Secondly, in Psalms, there is no phony spirituality whatsoever. There doesn't seem to be any posturing, no artificial piety. Human beings appear, that internal view, the range of human feeling and thought, and lots of it isn't pretty at all. There's some really ugly stuff boiling around on the inside of the psalm writers. So, no phony spirituality, no cliches, no canned metaphors, no phony spirituality. And third, they just cover enormous territory. You understand how this works in our own minds. We get a narrow range, but think of what is covered in the Psalms. You get everything from penitence to praise, to anger, to depression, to temptation, to fear, to blind white hatred. And it's all there. The privileged view is all there from the inside. So how do you experience God? Let's go to Psalm 33 and see how did this writer experience God. Incidentally, it's in a part of the Psalms that David wrote almost all of them, except he doesn't put his name on this one, so we don't know if this is one of David's Psalms or not. I'm going to read it, but I'm going to ask you not to read along. You may have noticed this before, but when you're reading this kind of scriptural passage, translations vary enormously. It's hard to render the Hebrew, and the differences can be jarring, and it you might find yourself more confused than helped by reading along. But let me go through it. That's a suggestion. If you're mad at me for suggesting it, go ahead and read along. See what you get. I'll bet you get cross-eyed once or twice, though. Rejoice in the Lord, O you righteous, for praise from the upright is beautiful. Praise the Lord with a harp. Make melody to him with an instrument of 10 strings. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully with a shout of joy, for the word of the Lord is right, and all his work is done in truth. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays out the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He makes the plans of the people of no effect. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he has chosen as his own inheritance. The Lord looks from heaven. He sees all the sons of men. From the place of dwelling, he looks on the inhabitants of the earth. He fashions their hearts individually. He considers all their works. No king is saved by the multitude of an army. A mighty man is not delivered by great strength. A horse is a vain hope for safety. Neither shall it deliver any by its great strength. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his mercy to deliver their soul from death, to keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield, for our heart shall rejoice in him, because we have trusted in his holy name. Let your mercy, O Lord, be upon us, just as we hope in you. So, how do you experience God when you're in this passage? Verses 1 through 3 would say worship. Verse 2 says praise from the upright is beautiful. But we want to get that right, because it seems to me that the Bible will portray lots of phony worship for you. I mean, it mocks the worship of people as often being invalid, misguided, not directed at all, where the people would pretend to be directing it. I say, well, that's very interesting. Think about this issue of worship as an experience of God's presence. We cannot fire up the presence of God or manipulate his interaction with us by getting wound up or intense during worship. There's no Bible verse that will support you in this. It would be a very pagan view of worship to think that by our frenzied activity, we would somehow or other invoke the presence of God. It does seem that there's a spontaneous element to it, but I want to point out that in this psalm anyway, in the first few verses, there's a lot of musical virtuosity. You don't play skillfully if you just started yesterday. The shouts seem to be timely shouts, not necessarily just spontaneous uproar. Creative new compositions are the new song to praise the Lord with. And it is, according to verse 2, beautiful. All I can say at this point is that to authentically experience the worship, to authentically experience God's presence with us, is to be provoked into worship. Now, don't reduce worship to singing, because it's a much, much bigger term than that. But if our experience of God does not move you to worship in one of its forms, it could be that you are not experiencing God. You're experiencing something else at that moment. Because worship appears to be the proper human response to immediate and direct contact with God. There are approaches that would not be helpful there. You can hear it in prayer language, and you can see it in yourself as you approach God then in reflexive worship. I remind you, you are not a peasant coming to appease a tyrant with flattery. That is not the relationship God has created with you. I would remind you too, I mean, with some probably some exceptions, that you are not a child. Rejoice in the fact that you are adult. The infantilizing effects some of our misguided thinking, I think, is very destructive to us in this. We are not pagans trying to invoke God's presence in ecstatic, or you might say, hysterical states of mind. We are adults who were created to share God's glory, who come in to experience the presence of God. Apparently, spontaneously, it will come out of us. With a great deal of preparation and plan, it will come out of us. But we will find worship to be meaningful and beautiful. Our primary experiences of God cannot really be understood apart from that reflex to worship Him. And if it's not there, then perhaps it's not an experience of God Himself. So worship is worth our time, our energy then. So how else? He doesn't leave you in the first three or four verses. How else do you experience God? Well, he jumps immediately to God's activities on earth, or activity on earth. And it brings in some concepts that are very advanced in some ways. You think, well, how did we jump from one to the other? He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. And with these words like justice, righteousness, goodness, and truth that populate the next few verses of the psalm, these require some thought, don't they? I mean, how do you know those things unless you direct your mind to them and analyze them and say, how is that so? Ask yourself just for a moment, is the world full of goodness? It's a great endeavor of the human mind to affirm that. There's certainly a lot of contrary evidence, isn't there? And there's certainly contrary evidence in your own life there. Justice, righteousness, and goodness are advanced ideas. But our sense of the presence of these things still in existence in the world lead us to God and to the experience of God. They're in us for that reason. For example, you say they don't exist. I have lots of friends who say those concepts don't really exist. And as much as they're there, they are man-made contrivances based on social contracts. It's the only way we can keep doing whatever we're doing here. But that doesn't account for the sense of violation, outrage, that something unfair happens, that even lead people to doubt. If those concepts have no substance beyond that, then why do you feel any anxiety at all over them if they're violated? How would those exalted ideas even come into existence if our only kind of mandate in our heart is to keep breathing? I mean, if that's all we're about, I'll keep breathing, and if I have to, I'll keep breathing at your expense. If that's my only priority, then why does a concept like justice or righteousness even begin to boil up inside me? Well, you see, when we look at this in the Psalms, we see that analysis and contemplation of these things can be an experience of God's presence. In other words, one does not have to become like the monkey, you know, shutting its eyes and its ears to the world's headlines to somehow shield out the world and to experience God. In fact, in all the boil and trouble of the world and of the evening news, you might say evening news, I mean the online news, you experience God there as well. Well, how else do you experience God, according to the psalm? He moves back in God's view of nature, or God's participation in nature, and talks about him as a creator in verses 6 through 9. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Now, the breath of his mouth creates, and he lays things up in storehouses and piles them up into heaps. This, my friends, is poetry. I don't think it is ever a proper biblical move to read the Bible as a geology textbook. I'd have to lay my cards on the table there. I think the Bible is at pains, though, at every pace, to let you know that everything that exists exists because God made it. God is present, but apart and sovereign over everything that exists. You realize, of course, that is a stunning faith assertion in a lot of the world these days. It's a claim that if it's true at all, is assigned to some remote territory where it doesn't really matter anymore. For example, lots of people think the material universe is eternal. That is hard to justify, by the way. We talk about things that are defensible philosophically. That one is really hard to defend, and I don't believe it. Claims that the order and the beauty that exist in the natural world, no matter how often violated or ignored in some ways by the human race, to suggest that that order is a blind and random development of a material universe is not just hard to justify, it's a statement of blind faith. I don't have that kind of faith, frankly. That's quite a leap to get there. The Bible would affirm us in saying that if the proper response to God's presence is worship, then the right response to the contemplation of the world around you is a path that leads you right back to God. So you feel like God isn't around? I don't suggest running into the church and pulling down the blinds and closing the doors. I would say that the investigation of every cell, every screw and nail, every car, every bird in the sky, you start to name natural processes from their most minute level to their grandest, and big play out are, in a sense, an experience of God as not just the author of nature, but the one who sustains and makes it possible. We hold a providential view of nature. This means that nature is there to provide for us, and God superintends that process. God cares for us and takes care of us with that nature. God didn't just make that natural world, but continues to control and superintend it, even the social and political world. You have to be very careful there, don't you? With some of the assertions the psalm makes there, saying the council of nations doesn't count. It's the council of God that counts. Clearly, in the broader picture of the scriptures, humans have a position of responsibility, and they are truly empowered to inflict damage on one another. It can happen. But that is compatible with the faith claim that God is still sovereign. He's the one running the show. In verses 10 and 12, the Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. When you look across the world, you think, is that true? The various systems seem impersonal, cold, or indifferent at best, but some of them seem, beyond that, to be fully in the hands of evil people, men and women. But the Bible claims you can experience that differently. Once again, it might be our tendency to think you have to screen out the world as it exists to be in the presence of God, but that the Bible never calls you to a naive faith. Just as in the case of nature, you're invited to see that God is present in the world. And it may look like the world possesses final authority and all the force behind it, but it is actually God who runs history. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. The number of times I've heard that pulled out of context, I can't count. You might be tempted to claim it for your own country, but in fact, I'm afraid from Bible interpretation standpoints, it is a direct reference to the kingdom of Israel about the time of King David, which would have been about 3,000 years ago. And believe me, he wasn't inviting anybody else into the role. There's a form of Christian faith that is always trying to expropriate national promises from the Old Testament to Israel to modern nations. But I think you'll find that you'll run into various places where that conflicts very much with the new covenant. But the point here is, with all this, is there's nothing that's news to God. It's part of his plan. We will experience him as both the controller and the preserver, not just of the small forces, but the large forces of our life. He looks on all the inhabitants of the earth. He fashions their hearts individually. He considers all their works. So we experience God not only as a sense of feeling that he is near, perhaps handling the big events of history, but a faith statement that says, he knows me personally. Life as you experience it doesn't have to be put on God's back burner while he manages the major affairs of things like that and doesn't have time for you. In fact, God is intimately at work with each of us. It seems to me that Christians drift between two extremes. I mean, one of them is kind of egocentric. You know, you think that to hear that Christian talk, that the planets and even the sun revolve around that individual for a while at least. But that doesn't work real well, I mean, in some ways, so when we're trying to look at the world this way. But at the same time, there are people who then plunge themselves into doubt and are asking where God is. And one friend who put it, God does not seem to be returning my calls. Oh, it's a tremendous image, and I think we all know the experience, but the fact is, God's on the line. Now, whether he's going to return our calls our way, I don't know, but in fact, I believe he's on the line. Faith says the experience of God is indeed personal, in many ways, private. Verse 16 goes on and says the experience of God too. It doesn't lapse into a kind of a sickening triumphalism, but says God is experienced in weakness. A mighty man is not delivered by great strength. Now, whatever truth there is to the idea of the survival of the fittest, it is clearly not the last word if the Bible's telling the truth. There are moments when we feel weak, threatened, and perhaps don't just feel that way, but in fact are weak and threatened, and we are reminded that we experience God especially in times of weakness. Our moments of thinking, likewise on the other side, that we're invincible or somehow competent enough or powerful enough, and we find out, no, we're not, according to God and according to the Scripture. Survival of the fittest doesn't get the last word when our faith wakes us up. Outcomes to us may be inscrutable, but God is a factor when we're weak and when we're strong. Verse 18, experiencing God, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his mercy, to deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. We've tried very hard in the modern church to eliminate the word fear, appropriate fear, out of the Scriptures, and we've not only succeeded, but we took a lot of stuff with it. We took awe, majesty, wonder, and appropriate humility out of the picture at the same time. In fact, I think God can be scary. Lots of people who have your best interest at heart and love you dearly can be scary. Those who don't think so, I'm always reminded of C.S. Lewis. Haven't you ever been to the dentist? I mean, maybe not your dentist loves you, of course, but things that can be good for you can be scary. They can be painful. We can experience God in those places that present us with a terrible picture of what God might allow, of what the world is really like, what we must give up, what must become of us, what might not become of us. Mortality itself comes into this picture. We're talking, in this case, in the psalm, in case we've gotten sappy here or anybody's inclined, he said, famine has come about here. Death and famine. We're not talking about minor aches and complaints and the inconveniences, but life itself. A life cut short with all its dreams, for example. Then comes to verse 20 and says, our soul waits for the Lord. I think the idea of waiting as a normal mode in experiencing God has to be nurtured in the church. Of course, we want cycles of resolution to come in minutes, not hours. But I fear at my age I'm learning to realize that some of them are marked off in years, in decades. Some of them I think maybe there's not an answer coming on that particular issue. Perhaps I die and it's a great mystery, but I will still wait for the Lord. I don't know why God allowed or didn't allow or blessed or didn't seem to bless or changed this or changed that. It's this talk about famine and death and waiting in those kind of circumstances to say, this is authentic. This is in harmony with my experience. I would be so suspicious if the Bible told me that there was no danger, no death, no threat. No threat ever. Everything would be tied up neatly and quickly. In short, I would get whatever I wanted from the divine online shopping center, wherever it is, and it would be sent to me in the mail. That is not life in the Lord as I've experienced it. And I don't think a Christian is demonstrating great faith by saying it is. The artificiality of that smiling Christian, I think, is usually committing foolishness, not faith, in those kind of situations. There's a lot in any life not to smile about. And yet the psalm calls us back saying, he is our help and our shield. When I think about that when I'm thinking of the experience of God and being given a shield. You don't need a shield if there's nothing to be shielded from. Now, maybe we'd all rather be in a situation not requiring a shield, but it's certainly a wonderful thing to have when you want one, right? And then you think, who is our shield? The Lord himself. The point of all this message is we're trying to give shape and definition to our experience of God. Our experience of Him is primary. It needs to be the first thing we put before ourselves when we think about being followers of Jesus Christ every morning, every moment of the day. If I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, it's pointless unless I say, and how do I experience God at this moment? In Psalms, we get a better picture of the interior world of one individual's experience at one time. It's a privileged view. Reading the Psalms, just about any Psalm, you're seeing that one person's experience. And I love these Psalms because they don't idealize any human soul. We are there in all the ugly glory, all the internal dialogue you could cook up on your own, speaking to God privately in ways you never would in public worship, and you won't beat the Psalms. Believe me, some of the stuff that's in there. They don't paint the world of the movies or of television. It's a world we know. It's beautiful, yet it's brutal. Excuse me. It's beautiful, yet it's brutal. Full of misspoken words, too. You know, what can I say? No matter how hard you try to be articulate, you always just come up with some doozies. I would just want to invite you this morning, as the close of this message, to feed on it, to spend time in prayer and meditation on the Psalms, and to start and end your process with saying, how is it that I experience the presence of God right now? Can I just call you for a moment to that? Just as an exercise, I'm not trying to manipulate your prayer life or your internal dialogue. Just ask the Lord, how is it I experience your presence at this moment?